Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we've delivered the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. We are excited to be back in 2022. A happy new year to all of our listeners, and we're happy to have you with us. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to subscribe, leave us a five-star review, and share this episode. All right, let's get started. Our guest today, we are excited to have her on. She is a cannabis industry entrepreneur, having launched the financial news website Green Market Report in September of 2017, and where she continues to serve as executive editor. She is in high demand to present at conferences, so you may have seen her speaking or moderating a panel, as I did recently in Washington, D.C. And she currently sits on the board of the Cannabis Newswire Access Wire, and also is a co-founder of the Cannabis Executive Women's Networking Group, Industry Power Women. Please welcome Deborah Borchardt. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And as always, I am pleased to welcome back the leader of our amazing research team, Chief Knowledge Officer here at New Frontier Data. Please welcome back Mr. John Caggia.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you.
Well, Deborah, we are thrilled to have you on. And just looking over your LinkedIn profile, I mean, you've had quite the career path going back to, you know, time in the finance industry with Bear Stearns, and then reporter, producer at The Street. You're a contributor for Forbes. We want to hear a bit more about what made you take your expertise to cannabis in 2017. Why then? What was going on?
Well, I actually started following and reporting on cannabis back in 2013 when I was at The Street, but mainstream media back then really saw no value in reporting on cannabis companies. There was really just penny stocks back then, and most of them were actually fairly shady endeavors. Most of them would just put the word cannabis or marijuana, not even cannabis, because back then it was just marijuana in the title of the company, and then sell a bunch of shares and have literally nothing to do with cannabis whatsoever. So for me as a reporter, this was pretty fascinating stuff because there was a lot of movement in these stocks. There was a lot of, like I said, a lot of shadiness going on. So as a reporter, it was great stuff, but mainstream media really did not want to cover cannabis back then. And at a certain point, I ended up leaving The Street and freelancing because I really felt like I wanted to spend all my time covering cannabis, not just doing it at the end of the day when all my other work was done. And so I was writing at various outlets like Seeking Alpha and Forbes and such, but I wasn't able to write the way I wanted to write. These were either stock jocks or very 50,000 foot level type writing. So that's why I started Green Market Report in 2017, because I just wasn't finding the kind of cannabis journalism that I wanted to see. And so I created it.
That's amazing. did you have like people clamoring to join that? I mean, being a reporter and a journalist, I feel like that would be such an interesting new industry to report on, that to have actually serious journalism going into it.
Yeah. You know, the thing that we really felt like we stayed true to our mission, you know, that was what I chose to do, was take a fairly narrow approach to cannabis coverage. Most of the cannabis media at that time was pretty focused on lifestyle, culture topics. If you did have business writing about cannabis, it was often not very analytical. There wasn't a lot of value add. You saw a lot of just rehashing of press releases rather than saying, oh, here's a press release, but here's what it really means. So I felt like by carving out this piece of reporting, we made ourselves something unique. And that's held true. And even though there were often temptations to go beyond that, I felt that it was most important to just kind of stay true to that very narrow focus. And I really think, you know, overall in media, you're starting to see more of that push within media is to go for these narrow silos of very targeted audiences, such that if you cover a topic, you're covering a real specific part of that topic. And so you've got a real sticky, loyal audience.
Yeah, right. So true. John, before we move on, any hot questions for Deborah while she's in the hot seat?
Well, no, you know, I've just really kind of respected the way that the role that Deborah has played in shifting the way the media covers this space. As she said, it was such a one size fits all kind of approach and tended to be very soft. And so to see that kind of carefully considered Wall Street kind of perspective coming into the market where, I think it leveled up and that was almost like the advent of this diffusion that we've seen of specialization, much, much sharper and tighter reporting. And I think that served the industry really well. I think it's made it a space that now begins to feel a lot more like a lot of other spaces where investors and other stakeholders are playing in because you can find your niche and drill in deep. So. And big fan of Deborah's work.
Right, John. And I think too, what was happening was you had some outlets covering cannabis stocks, but they weren't really they didn't want to say anything negative. They That's wanted right. it to That's be right. all just rainbows and unicorns. And we love cannabis so much that we're going to just love all the cannabis stocks, no matter whether they're run badly or not. And that was just not great for the investors because the investors, right. if they went to some places, would see all this wonderful stuff about a company and then not knowing what was really going on within the company. And so, you know, that was where Green Market Report stepped in, was we were willing to, you know, uncover the warts and discuss the challenges that some of these companies were facing. And while sometimes the companies got upset with that, you know, I would always remind them, look, you know, when you do well, I'm going to point out that you've done well. And so there's going to be a lot more credibility to that article of you've done well versus you getting mad of me saying, wow, you really stumbled this quarter. You need to get, you know, things need to be pulled together and you're spending too much, your debt's too high, whatever. You know, they shouldn't be afraid of me. They should just be focused on what they're doing.
So in that line, Deborah, I'm curious on your perspective of with this idea of both the truth telling and calling the industry's baby ugly when it's warranted. What's your outlook for the state of kind of media in this space moving forward?
You know, I think we're going to start to see more of the mainstream operators get involved. We just got acquired by Crane Communications just a few months ago in October. And I think that's indicative of what we're seeing. And I think because you're starting to see more of the mainstream media seeing dispensaries open up in their states, seeing these huge sales numbers and tax revenues. And as it just continues to grow and expand, it's less threatening and less stigmatized. So I would expect you're going to start to see more reporters having cannabis as a beat. Right now, I mean, John, you and I could probably name all the cannabis reporters that do this full time. And I would say it's probably less than 10 of us that and really truly business cannabis reporters that do this as a beat. You know, there's quite a few that do it part-time. There's quite a few do it freelancing or just culturally and lifestyle type of stuff. But as far as business, it's just a very small group of us.
Right. Well, thank you for that. All right. Well, we are going to move on. WIFR.com reports there's no plateau in sight for skyrocketing Illinois cannabis sales. So this pandemic has created a ton of challenges for many businesses, but cannabis continues to prove resistant to negative market forces. And Illinois has set another sales record in December by bringing in nearly $1.4 billion in sales in 2021. So Deborah, we all remember when cannabis businesses were declared essential and allowed to stay open while other businesses were forced to shutter their doors. How do you think the pandemic has changed the way retailers engage with consumers?
So the pandemic for just regular consumers, most consumers were able to switch their consumption to an online model. As you know, everybody is buying from Amazon and things like that. But with cannabis, you're still going to a brick and mortar store. You might make a purchase online, but you're still picking it up at the store, or it's being delivered directly to you from that outlet. There's no middleman. It's just that direct relationship. And I think that as we see these markets continue to expand, you know, that the pandemic really didn't change too much with regards to these outlets other than processing the purchases. So, and I think that, and we'll probably get into this later, but I think that model, the online purchasing and the pickup in the store, I think that might start to get affected by the whole banking issue and the memo that we got from Visa not long ago, a few weeks ago. Everybody was talking about that. I think that's really going to have the most effect on this situation. Up until this point during the pandemic, as these cannabis companies were using programs like Dutchie to process these online orders so then people could just walk in the store and pick up their little bag, I think that's going to find itself in a lot of, I don't want to say hot water, but a lot of challenges, because it sounds like that cashless ATM transaction is being targeted by Visa. And so while during the pandemic, it was kind of overlooked, I think that now as we start to roll out of the pandemic, that is not going to be overlooked anymore. So I think that the cannabis companies kind of got relaxed into this type of transaction. And I think they're going to find out that they're going to have to pivot now out of the pandemic and address that situation and how they can do those transactions. But yes, Illinois has been crushing it, along with Michigan. Those two Midwestern states have just really, you know, gone crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a lot of cannabis businesses figured once all these changes have been made, you can't put that, you know, that genie back in the bottle, right?
So that's what they think. You'd be surprised. But yes, I think everybody's gotten complacent and comfortable with the cashless ATM transaction.
As have the consumers, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, I just was at a dispensary on Saturday in Massachusetts, and I like to go into different dispensaries and talk to people and stuff. And sure enough, I'm polite. I make a purchase, and sure enough, it was the cashless ATM. And the whole time I'm doing it, I'm thinking, I know this is not allowed, and I'm doing it anyway. And I know it's not allowed. But everyone's doing it, I think, and everyone's doing it until they're not going to be able to do it.
Right. John, what are your thoughts on that?
I see a lot of potential here for the law of unintended consequences, partly because the cashless ATM model has been adopted so widely, and with a lot of consumers who've now gotten very comfortable with being able to place orders online, whether that's for the delivery to the home or for in-store pickup or for curbside pickup. The potential catalytic effect of Visa bringing the hammer down on the industry is that it now kind of lays bare a really easily understood challenge that this industry is facing due to the lack of a coherent federal policy around this. So, you know, this is an industry that is generating revenue hand over fist now. And particularly as you see the activation of these East Coast markets that are going to be dynamic, but in the kind of centers of power, the idea that, you know, the cashless ATM option, which does help expedite and streamline business operations, if that now goes away, we go back to a cash-based model at a time that the industry is seeing, you know, year-over-year increases in sales to the tune of like $4-5 billion a year. There's going to be a very strong case to be made about the urgency for the federal government to address this. Now, it creates a tension between, does the federal government try and address this whole cloth, you know, finally get to decriminalization and a robust federal policy, or does it create a carve-out exception just to address the banking, finance, and taxation issues? But either way, I think this just becomes now another point of pressure that stimulates the discussion at the federal level about the unsustainability of the constraints being placed on an industry that is growing explosively. The cannabis industry is also phenomenally entrepreneurial and innovative. So, you know, this is an industry that has found workarounds to the constraints around it for years. And I certainly don't put it past this industry to find a creative solution if cashless ATMs goes away until this gets resolved. So I'm curious to see what else might come down the pike as a viable alternative if this current option goes away.
And that seems to be happening already. There are already several companies that, like you said, John, see this as an opportunity to create a product. I'm hearing of groups that are getting together to have basically a credit card that is used within their own system. So it isn't even going into the Visa MasterCard platform. So that, you know, certainly I think is going to create lots of opportunity. And as we've seen, and within the cannabis industry, some of the stuff that gets created within the cannabis industry sometimes gets, you know, expanded into other more mainstream businesses. So it's certainly, I think it's, you know, it will be disruptive without a doubt, but it also gives an opportunity for some other upstarts.
Exactly right.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems like we are going into another year of this pandemic. So with this strong performance of Illinois and Michigan, like you said, what do you expect for 2022?
You know, if New Jersey starts their sales, and a lot of people I've talked to have said that they could start sales as soon as this summer.
Ocean City, New Jersey, and
I mean, some of the medical operators are already applying for the licenses. And I mean, when you've already got the stores up and running and they've been running fairly smoothly, that's what I've heard, is that it's very possible that if they get some of this stuff fast tracked, those outlets could start selling sometime this summer. I think if that happens, it's so game changing, because I think it's definitely going to affect Pennsylvania, which has been another one of those up and coming states. Pennsylvania's medical only, but they have been opening stores right and left, or medical dispensaries right left, constantly opening new outlets. I think that's going to hurt the Pennsylvania market. I think it's going to push the Pennsylvania market to move a little faster. I'm curious whether it will draw some of those sales from Massachusetts, because right now Massachusetts is getting a lot of business from New Yorkers and Connecticut. So, you know, right now I have to drive 2 hours to get to a dispensary in Massachusetts. Well, New Jersey is really just, you know, a half hour away from me. So I might, you know, shift my dollars over there. And I'm sure I'm not the only other person that could say, wow, it's just a whole lot easier for me to go to Jersey. And I think that New Jersey market, there was, I think it was Headset that put out a report last week or earlier this week that was saying New Jersey is going to be, you know, one of the top five markets in the country. And I think that could be true. So I think that we could see that. I think we're also going to see a lot of upheaval in California. California is a hot mess. I was just out there last month for the NCIA conference. I had so many people in my ear telling me how awful things are out there. I think I just saw something from the governor, Gavin Newsom, who said, I'm going to address the tax issue in cannabis in California. And a lot of people are very skeptical that he's actually going to do something. But it is such a mess. And the illegal market there is growing and getting even stronger than it was before. So I think something's going to need to happen in California. I think it's just going to get harder for the legitimate players to compete against the not so legitimate players.
Right.
And I don't even want to get into the whole legacy and all that stuff, all that that whole conversation about legacy stuff, because the people I'm talking about are not the mom and pop farmer that was in Humboldt 40 years ago. I'm talking about people that are brand new that are just piling on to the illegal market. And they're just enjoying running a business without paying any taxes.
Yeah. Well, John, I know our team has done a lot of outlook on, you know, the Jersey market. What's your opinion on that?
So I actually shared Deborah's view in that the regional cannabis tourism that New Jersey is going to enjoy when that switch flips is going to be both very dramatic, we expect, and lead a lot more of these East Coast markets that are literally watching their consumers drive over the border or drive over several borders to get to Jersey. You know, the I think it's going to influence the speed at which the conversation happens in New York. I think it's going to influence kind of that entire eastern seaboard, the mid-Atlantic region, where the conversation has been relatively slow in moving. But for example, I'm curious to see how this tension builds between the Jersey Shore and Ocean City, Maryland, as, you know, for those who are looking for an East Coast summer holiday. I think this makes, you know, the Jersey Shore look like a much more attractive destination for a certain type of both tourist and consumer. There's a couple of other things around the East Coast dynamics that I think are compelling. Pennsylvania's medical market has been growing like gangbusters. And, you know, it based on the set of qualifying conditions that it has, that it's broad, expansive, and relatively easy to participate. We think there's at least a proportion of participants in the medical cannabis program in Pennsylvania that are using the program for affirmative defense. However, it's a really expensive program to participate in. So if you can drive across the border to go to New Jersey to get what will likely be more affordable cannabis and then be able to consume it without being molested by law enforcement back in Pennsylvania, I think that becomes a big attractor of tourism across the Pennsylvania border. And that's going to have an impact on pushing, we think, the Pennsylvania industry to champion legalization in a way that has been a slow burn thus far. I am curious to see what happens when we start seeing recreational dispensaries opening in Virginia, and particularly the impact that has on the national conversation, just because, you know, as we're speaking just before this, DC is right on the border of Virginia. Congress is literally within eyeshot of some major towns that on the outskirts of DC. And it will be interesting to see how so many lawmakers, policy influencers, there's 150 plus embassies in DC, how these stakeholders who are influencing both domestic and international policy start to react when dispensaries start opening in their communities. It's adult use dispensaries start opening in the communities. I think for a lot of stakeholders, this has been an abstract conversation. And the opening of a regulated market in Virginia, I think, is going to be could challenge kind of some longstanding assumptions or misconceptions about what a regulated cannabis economy could look like. And then finally, maybe just one macro point, which we're watching quite closely, because we think this could be one of the things that could potentially consequentially impact the trajectory of the market this year, which is the broader economic conditions. We're in a stage of growth where this industry's expansion is very, very capital intensive. And the dynamic we're watching out for is whether broader economic and headwinds end up resulting in a constriction to the amount of capital flowing into cannabis. And therefore, even though we continue to see very strong consumer demand has proven to be very, very resilient. But whether that actually slows the expansion of an industry because businesses having more trouble raising capital to expand, to acquire, to scale, to innovate, it doesn't diminish the long-term opportunity of the market. It may just slow the pace of growth that we've been seeing if capital constraints become a big issue as we go into the year ahead.
Thank you for that. Well, moving on, SeattleTimes.com reported what to expect for cannabis in 2022. So as we've discussed, there's a lot to be excited about, but a few things to be concerned about. Deborah, you have extensively covered cannabis financial markets. What's your outlook for cannabis capital markets in 2022?
I kind of agree with John in a way. I think that a lot of the big money deals that we saw last year and even the year before, I don't think we're going to see as many of those. I feel like the SPACs have maybe run their course. The SPACs were all these massive, like 100 million, 200 million, and they just didn't have really the companies to go after. And they've in my opinion, kind of overinflated the values of some of the companies that were seen as qualifying transactions because they just didn't have a lot to choose from. So they went, oh, we'll take company A over here. And then you would look at it and go, well, company A only has this much in revenue. And wait, you're buying them for how much? Yeah. Like, it wasn't making any sense. And then the secondary market for those SPAC shares is awful. And so you start to get into a situation like we see with like say the parent company where it's just, you know, $500 million charge. I just, my gut is we're not going to see as many of those big honking deals that we saw. Also, the stocks have really been in a terrible bear market for almost 2 years now. We've had a quarter here or there where things turned around, but overall, the valuations have just been squashed. So for, you know, the investor, it feels like you're throwing bad money after good, or good money after bad. I think that appetite is starting to wane. So I think it's actually going to be a lot harder to raise money, maybe not on a smaller scale. I just saw that Garden Society did a Series A, raised $7 million. I think that's so great, great company, great female-led company. So maybe we'll see more of those smaller deals where the investors are hoping to find that next brand that's going to really resonate and could go national, if, you know, as national as you can go on cannabis, but be more of a multi-state brand.
Got it. John, anything to add to that?
Yeah, just you know, we've seen that the stock market has been very news driven. There's a lot of retail investors who will see a headline and rush to buy. At least that's the way it used to play, and there just hasn't been a lot of good news, particularly anchored around kind of this federal story. You know, I think that helped buoy prices in 2020 coming into 2021. But once it became clear that the federal story wasn't going to be happening, it will take some significant developments, we think, to drive those prices back up to what we were seeing a few years ago. Not ruling it out, but it's hard to see from where we're starting off this year, the sort of catalytic event that would lead to the burst of enthusiasm, in some cases irrational enthusiasm, but the burst of enthusiasm that we've seen in past year cycles of this market.
Right.
And maybe, well, I'll put that question to Deborah. You know, do you see a catalytic event that could lead to a turnaround for the broad market as opposed to individual companies?
That's a tough one because, you know, we've seen the provinces in Alberta and Ontario issue so many licenses that a lot of the companies in those provinces in Canada have had declining sequential sales. So that was not a good, as you point out, not a good headline. And then we have seen, like, we were talking about Michigan being such a great state, but if you start to look at Michigan sales, they've also started to kind of plateau and even tip a little to the downside. So I feel like, you know, I don't think legislation-wise, I personally don't see that anything's going to happen this year on legislation. I feel like if we would have seen it, we would have seen it. I could be wrong, and I'm happy to be wrong on that. I'm not a political reporter. But I haven't heard of any positive comments around that area. So I kind of feel like it starts to, I hate to say it, kind of point back to Jersey, and only because Jersey is close to New York. And so you've got all this media, and I feel like that's going to be the impetus. We did get good numbers from Tilray this week, which helped tremendously. And I felt like that when Organigram had a great quarter. So hopefully if we start to see some of these companies coming out with a good solid quarter, we'll be able to get past some of the bad headlines. We've had several companies teeter on bankruptcy. That hasn't helped either. I've heard a lot of rumblings about hedge funds in Canada, you know, shorting a lot of the stocks, which can't be proved or really addressed. So I feel like if anything is going to be the positive catalyst, that it's going to be Jersey.
So no pressure on the New Jersey market. Pull the entire industry out of its doldrums.
All on Jersey's shoulders. It's all on the Garden State. We're all going to go there so we can have them pump gas in our cars so we don't have to get out of the car.
Isn't that the saying, Jersey strong? So they got to be strong.
And that's for the audience. If people out in the audience that are listening to this, if you've ever been to New Jersey, it is unlike any state when you pull up into the gas station, because they still have gas station attendants that pump the gas in your car. You do not get out of your car. And it's a step back in time. That's a beautiful thing. I think all states should go back to having gas station attendants.
Well, unless you're at some place where they're like, lady, get back in your car. And then it's not quite the step back in time.
Right.
Well, moving on. So looking at European markets, American operators, investors have largely ignore the European markets, which have been pretty slow to launch and operationalize. What impact do you think Germany's announcement that the country will legalize adult use will have on how American stakeholders start viewing international markets?
You know, I've seen a lot of talk about Germany being a $5 billion market, that it's going to be this huge market, that Germany is going to kick everything off for Europe. I guess I'm a lot less positive about that. You know, Germany has had legal medical marijuana since 2017. It's not been huge. It's not been a big adoption. Every time I see these big numbers, it's all like big numbers around forecasts and not big numbers in actuality. And I was looking at 2019, so pre-pandemic, 2019, total Europe was sales were $250 million. Total Europe. That's like one quarter for Green Thumb Industries. And the US did 12.1 billion. Now, granted, the US is, you've got a lot of rec sales in there. But the European market still has a lot of stigma. I mean, they've had CBD there for years, and they're still, that market still hasn't even bought a bunch of CBD because they're freaked out and think CBD is going to get them high. I mean, there's so much misinformation. I just don't see that the numbers are going to be all that big. And I think that's why a lot of the American companies, when they took a look at it, backed away from it, because it was going to be a huge investment and the payoff wasn't really going to be there. It may not be there for many years. And then you've also got the situation in Europe that almost is similar to the United States in that each country has its own set of rules and regs. It's not going to be like the EU where they're all going to have one standard for cannabis. Each country is going to be different with the packaging and the rules. And it's going to be, if you thought the United States was hard to navigate for cannabis, I think the Europe is just going to be even harder. Having said that, to me, the promise is in Eastern Europe. I think Eastern Europe, you'll see much more adoption of cannabis companies, because you're going to be able to give people jobs. You have a lot of depressed areas that you can refurbish and restore for cannabis facilities. You've got a cheap labor force. So I feel like we're probably going to see more happening in Eastern Europe as far as cannabis growth, just because of that, because it gives them jobs and it helps depressed locations. That's kind of what we saw in the United States when we saw like Colorado and, you know, Washington and Oregon. Those cities where they first started putting dispensaries were always in the crummy parts of town. They were always in the rundown industrial areas, and that's who started it. And that's where things got started. I guess I feel like, to me, that's where we really see the growth in Europe is Eastern Europe. I just don't think that the numbers are going to be all that huge in Germany.
Right. John, what do you think about those numbers for Germany? Or why do you think that they are projected to be where they are?
So I think there's a couple of dimensions to the German story that we find really compelling in the outlook. So one is that the fact that this was an announcement made by a newly elected coalition government relatively soon after the election. So this was an announcement that was made in December. The election was in late September. I don't think anyone really expected this to be one of the new government's priorities. And so it makes us wonder whether, you know, there's some intention here to move quite quickly to do this. The question is, what does this end up ultimately looking like? What does the regulatory structure that's going to be proposed look like? So I think the fact that it does look, at least from early indications, that there's some intention to move robustly around this. Clearly, the German public is behind this, given that four of the five parties that were vying for the Bundestag in September had included in their policy proposals drug policy reform. I think there's been this kind of coalescing around this idea that it was time for this to happen in Germany. The nature and form, ultimate form of the regulated market, I think, is the wild card question, and that's going to dictate what the revenue opportunity looks like. But there does seem to be some intentionality around from the administrative state. Second, I would not underestimate, or at least we think that there's something to be said for the gravitational pull of Germany as Europe's largest economy, as Europe's most influential economy. And for some of these neighbors, where there have been quiet conversations happening in Italy and France and Spain, in Portugal, to move toward a regulated market, I think this animates that conversation. Other countries may not necessarily follow suit in the same way or do so quickly. But we, based on some of the conversations we've already had this year, it does appear that it is stimulating a conversation around, now that Germany has done this, what does this mean for our own country? Totally agree with Deborah's point that the German medical market has languished for years, and there's been some significant operational challenges there. And for the stakeholders who got started there early, it's been a tough slog. Recouping the investments from that market has been really, really challenging. I have to assume that they're quite kind of excited about the potential of being able to translate and capture some of the adult use market, much like we're seeing in New Jersey or we saw in markets like Illinois, where the medical market was a really tough place to do business. But if you survived and made it out of that, then when the switch got flipped, you were actually in a really strong position because you trimmed the fat, you'd learned how to operate lean, you'd figured out a product mix that may have been small, but was well suited for your audiences. And so I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing such strong performance in these markets is these operators who survived that long dry spell were really well framed now for to capitalize on the very substantial opportunity on the rec side.
And when you think about it too, the argument of, oh, well, if Germany legalizes, that's going to, set off this chain reaction in Europe. I mean, when you think about it, Amsterdam's been legal for decades. They've never started some chain reaction over Europe, and with Amsterdam having legal cannabis and having had it for, I mean, I remember when I was 15, I was in Amsterdam and I saw little tugboats with plants all over it. And I don't want to say all of them, but that was a long time ago. So it's been that Amsterdam didn't exactly, start a domino effect in the country. So.
Fair, but also don't think anyone looked at Amsterdam and thought we would want this in our communities. Like, I don't think
question is, are they going to look at Germany and go, yes, so I want this? Because Czech Republic also has had some kind of legal cannabis. I mean, I was there a few years ago and saw it.
And I think the point you make is an important one, which is in the North American markets, our reflex has been to make this a capital-driven kind of revenue model. Like we have built this as capitalistic cannabis economies. I think that's going to get tested in Europe. I think we're going to see first the real challenges to whether to make this a stark for-profit market or whether there are ways to do this through the social club model, through the a community-based model, the co-op model. I think there's going to be much more kind of consideration of that, partly because the dynamics that are shaping the legalization conversation in those countries is quite different than some of the dynamics that influence legalization in North America. The opportunity could ultimately end up looking quite different. I think entrepreneurs will find ways to capitalize on the gray spaces. I think the markets that go home grow as a primary source will you'll see home grow supplies take off. But I would not necessarily assume that Germany or the rest of the European market is going to end up looking like the MedRec model that we've seen in the US states or in Canada. I would expect that there's going to be some countries that decide to go for a less capital-based model and one that, say, looks more community-based transaction, kind of more cooperative-based cultivation and product sharing. But it's certainly going to be something to watch. I think it's going to be an interesting season over the next couple of years as these countries figure out what their potential approaches might be.
Well, John, I know you and I spoke about this and with Mitch as well, just about the normalization before legalization, especially in the U.S. And, you know, Deborah, as you said, you know, when you were there 15, it's probably still very taboo around the world, right? Like it's just, it was very not as normalized. Do you think that Europe will experience that normalization, that they may want that in their country? I know you're saying, do they really want to have that in their country like Amsterdam has had for years?
Yeah, you know, and it may be that when dispensaries start to open, like the modern dispensary, like what we see now when we go to California or Colorado or wherever, it is very enticing to go to these stores and to make purchases. And that could very well be what it takes to normalize it, to get it out of that stigmatization, which is definitely where it is.
Yeah.
Having said that, I feel like in the U.S., while there was some stigma, there was such a huge illicit market that in a way it was normalized.
Well, but I mean, you're talking about kind of like a seedy drug drug deal as opposed to going to like Planet 13, where it's like sophisticated glass cases and you can get a cup of coffee.
Right. But I guess that's what I say when normalization, in the sense of, I don't think anybody has ever had a problem buying weed in America. That's what I guess where I'm going with that is if you wanted to buy it, it was certainly fairly easy to find it. Did you know what you were buying? No, you just bought what you bought. You know, and you know, you had to usually sit in someone's random house on their random couch and, you know, whatever. I do think that could potentially change things. I mean, certainly with Amsterdam, you had to go to a cafe. You could only consume it in that cafe. It was very limited amount of options. Right. Yes, to your point, now you go into any dispensary and you've got loads of choices and beautiful packaging and lots of options. It's a lot of fun and it makes it a whole lot less scary.
Yeah. You
know? So if you're going in and buy a chocolate covered strawberry that's infused, yummy, you know?
Yeah. Or even like a honey for your tea. It's so sophisticated.
Yeah. And it, you know, and even here we've had a lot of education around just like CBD, and we're still in the education mode on CBD. So I think that, yeah, there's just going to be a big learning curve in those countries.
Right. Well, we have taken up a lot of your time, but before you go, we do like our guests to give a shout out to someone in the industry. If you have someone in mind that you want to give some props to.
You know, I want to give props to Rosie Matteo and Matteo Communications. I think they've done an amazing job. I've known Rosie, since I started Green Market Report in 2017, and she was a one-woman shop back then. She now has something like 60 employees. And I just love the fact that it's a female-owned company and that it's done a lot to promote a positive message for cannabis companies and the cannabis industry as a whole. So I guess that's my shout out.
All right. Well, go Rosie. Well, thank you both so much for your time. Deborah, we really appreciate you joining us. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. If you really like us, leave us a 5-star review. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. We're excited to be back and we will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.